After experiencing the transformative power of a regular meditation practice, it's natural to feel inspired to share this gift and guide others on their own journey of discovery through meditation. Join Buddhist teacher David Nichtern and Duncan Trussell, comedian and creator of the Netflix animated series The Midnight Gospel, for a free online event on Tuesday, May 7th at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. They'll discuss the profound practices of mindfulness in Dharma Moon's renowned mindfulness meditation teacher training program. Get certified by Dharma Moon to teach meditation, lead group practice sessions, and work with individual students. Visit dharmamoon.com/beherenow for more info and to reserve your spot for the free online event with David Nichtern and Duncan Trussell.
There is a place that's always here, that's in us, and that holds us, that is okayness. It's just a relief to finally land there, and from there to feel happy and sad, and from there to witness the horrors in the world and the exquisite beauty in the world, to really be okay with all of it. It's that dance, which is why I call it the artistry of that polarity, like to know that everything is fundamentally okay and to address all the fucked up things in the world at the same time, that those are not mutually exclusive.
Hey everyone, it's Raghu from Mind Rolling back again. And I'm happy to have a really old friend, Sarah Marshank. And we haven't talked to each other or seen each other since Ram Dass left, basically.
Yep.
And happy to have you. Welcome.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
So I've had fun because Sarah sent me a couple of books, one of which was her a memoir, right? And the other, which is a methodological book, if there's such a word.
I like that.
But called Selfistry, that has some really, important revelations, just interpreting what we all already know in a way that you can catch on where you maybe didn't before. Something can make sense, which is why this is all so lovely. But the fun part was, of course, reading the memoir, because I didn't know anything about that. Okay. I mean, oh my God, I don't know how far you want to get into it, but you know what? The reality is that this memoir, which is called Being Self-ish, which is good, I like that, I don't know if you would get the guidebook, you know, which is a guide to embodying timeless wisdom, spiritual wisdom. I don't know, because you have had a tremendous wealth of experiences and suffering. And so it informs how you're framing what people can perhaps think of and a little bit of a new perspective to help get along on a day to day. So let's start from the beginning.
Okay.
Just happy. Yeah, you grew up where and when and what was the societal atmosphere at the time? And go ahead.
Well, first of all, I just want to say what you just articulated is so helpful in that as we remember, you know, as we're walking each other home, as we're remembering that all frameworks and methodologies and traditions were born out of a context of the person or the peoples and their particular life circumstances, even though we could say there's a generic universal definition of suffering, the uniqueness of each person's particular circumstances, how could it not inform the methodologies and the tools and the practices? So and I love naming that for people because it gives us permission to find the ones that we resonate with if they're all really walking each other home. So, I love that. So my particular circumstance, born in 1963 in Detroit, Michigan, from Eastern European lineage. My family all left Eastern Europe before World War II, my immediate family. And many of my family also died in the war. And I was raised
in camps, you're saying?
In a variety of different circumstances. Mm. But obviously my immediate, or my grandparents immigrated before the war. They're from Belarus and Ukraine and Russia. And my family name, actually, my father's side was the rabbinical leaders of Poland at the time.
Oh, really?
Which I found kind of cool. And I've been there. So that's like the details of where I was born and when.
Yeah. And, but I'm most interested in the, 'cause we could really relate with the Jewish heritage. I've been talking to a lot of Jewish people lately.
Interesting.
I just talked to a young Jewish woman who is from Mumbai.
Oh.
Okay. And is the last of the, you know, maybe 3,000 Jews from that area. Right. I had never met anyone. So I said, I got to have you on a podcast. And we got to know each other a little bit. So definitely coming from that tradition, which certainly many, many people, because of the adventurous quality of their incarnation, Jews that went over to the East. And how many do we have? Some incredible teachers, Jack Kornfield and Sharon Salzberg and on and Ram Dass.
Right.
So,
exactly.
Yeah. So how did that shape you?
Well, I think more than anything, and the value of education and the value of being willing to investigate and interrogate and explore and adventure was kind of built into my DNA and into my family system and the way that I was raised. So I always felt like I could figure anything out if I just applied myself to it. And I think that served me well when I hit my pocket of suffering and really needed to figure out why I was here and what it was all about. And and I did go on to become an Orthodox Jew in my later 20s as part of my exploration. In the book, I moved to Muncie. I studied in yeshiva. I really did go back to my roots, so to speak. And I think that's when organized religion per se started to break down for me. And I really got to see that even if there was an essential truth embedded in Judaism, which I believe I have discovered, and Christianity and Islam and Hinduism and Buddhism, that that there was something about the container, you know, like we were talking about earlier, the context that didn't resonate for me, being a child of the 70s and in a Western society post-Vietnam. And so I feel like my longing to sort it out for myself, my Jewish heritage gave me the courage to do that and gave me, you know, the investigative chops, so to speak. Like I have a real rabbinical mind in a way. Mm. But the real work started when I finally sat down and shut up and began to meditate and pray in earnest from my own heart.
Mm. Before you went back into it, in an Orthodox manner, had you discovered Eastern traditions?
I started practicing yoga when I was 19. I was a student at UC Santa Cruz.
Hmm.
But that was more just yoga asana, not so much yoga philosophy. So no, I hadn't given it any earnest practice until I moved to Oregon and went into retreat for those 10 years.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Talk about that. And of course, one person runs pretty much throughout a lot of the book is a man named Sam, who seems like a very complex character. And I might have, if I had known you, I might have said something, shall we say, not so Nice.
Yeah, you and many others. But he, Sam was another conservative. Well, he was probably less raised less Jewish than you and I were from New York. And yeah, very interesting character and very, very fierce and dedicated to his own enlightenment. And so like any tradition in any monastery or any relationship, there's always a dark side and a light side. And what I appreciate about Sam was he created the conditions and an opportunity for me to really practice without, here's the dilemma, without a teacher, pros and cons. Mm. Right.
Well, he was your teacher.
No, he was my peer. Yeah. Huh. He was really my fellow monk. He had his ideas and his beliefs and his suppositions, but he, and though he wanted me to carry those as well, his fundamental injunction was always prove me wrong. Find out for yourself. And here's, I'm going to create the conditions for you to do that. Because if you sit down and shut up long enough, the truth will arise in you.
That sounds like a teacher. Sorry. You know, it's anyone who says, if this happens and if you do, you know, you are speaking as if you know something someone else doesn't.
Yeah, that's interesting. Okay. I can, you know, I can hang with him as that as well. He definitely played that role. But I, yeah. Yeah.
And you were married, although in a very unique way, shall we say?
We were fellow monks. We felt very much aligned in our quest for truth. And we supported each other 100% in that. And in that regard, we were united and we were never formally married. We never had sex. We were both celibate for that all that time that I was with, you know, living with him. And there were other people that practiced with us and spent time with us, but it really was a beautiful, I mean, it was hard lifestyle, but I had full permission to meditate for hours every day, do yoga, pranayama, study what I wanted to study, and spend time in nature. And it really was a full-on monastic, immersive lifestyle. We didn't have a television. We didn't go into town. We didn't, you know, engage really with the outside world, hardly at all. So it was pretty radical. Yes.
And you were in your 30s then?
That was my 30s. Yeah. The decade of my 30s. It was also the 90s. And my stepkids to this day joke with me about all the music I missed and during that decade.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. So, it sounds like at that point, that 10 years, as much as I got, was the most informative time of your life because you got to really, really face the insides, the guts of yours. And you had other traumatic events around pregnancy and so on. What led you out of that, and or what happened first? What happened after that stage?
After the 10 years?
Yeah.
Well, I think it's the same question. What happened that inspired me to leave and come back into the world? And you know, it's interesting because I feel like the echo of Ram Dass's teaching from role to soul, you know, I talk about in the book how we used to listen to cassette tapes of Ram Dass because Sam was really into Ram Dass and thought, you know, Ram Dass was really a very serious teacher and practitioner and very wise until after he stroked and he got more bodhisattvic in his ways. Mm. And Sam thought he maybe was going off track there. And yet I had this really deep resonance with the injunction to go from role to soul in my meditation practice and cultivating the witness, which is, and we can talk about that more, my conversations with Ram Dass about that and how the framework of sophistry is the same as what he's talking about in a different template, you could say, right? Mm-hmm. But while I was in retreat, that was, you could say that was my main practice. And then once I felt stable in the soul part and really understanding the perspective of role without rooting my identity into it, 9/11 happened. And that was the one event that actually, because Sam's family was from New York and his money was you know, generational wealth based upon his grandfather's investment in real estate in New York. So when 9/11 happened, his parents actually did call us to let us know that they were okay and the properties were okay. And something in my heart just broke open when I heard what had happened. And I told Sam I needed to go to a hotel so I could find a television so that I could see it. It was just this kind of magnetism. And then from then on, it took a few years, but I realized that what I had the privilege of attempting and realizing or experiencing in retreat, that it really, for me, and this is where Sam and I differed, for him, his journey was to stay and to continue to practice. And my journey was to bring that practice into the world and offer it the opportunity to come to fruition through connection, through relationship, through service, rather than just the monastic way. Yeah.
And so you went into the next part of your journey in your 40s, right?
Yep.
What was that?
So that was when I met Stephen, my husband, who you know. I found my way back into the world. I was trained as an educator. I had a master's degree in education before I went to be with Sam for those years. And also was a licensed massage therapist. So when I came out of retreat, I got a job as a massage therapist, which was perfect because I could still be quiet and slow and silent and meditative while touching people, and which was super beautiful. And my husband is a family man and a world traveler and also a deep spiritual practitioner, a psychonaut, also knew Ram Dass back in the day, produced a film, Prognosis, with Ram Dass in it. And so, you know, Steve, he was just connected to all these really beautiful teachers and systems and helped me kind of understand what had happened for me in those years with Sam and create an understanding of how they connected with other lineages and teachings. And then I just found my way into teaching again and creating this body of work pretty much organically. It wasn't something I set out to do. It was I started telling my story, and then I started developing my career again as a teacher and as an educator, very interested in how we raise young people, where's the role for mindfulness, meditation, critical thinking around spiritual traditions, the difference between religion and spirituality, social activism. And now, right, in 2023, and I loved your podcast, your conversation with your granddaughter. And now, Stephen and I have three granddaughters that are, you know, 9, 11, and 13, and really considering as an elder, as a grandmother, as an educator, how are we raising these next generations to engage in the meta crisis that we're living in these times? So I would say it's like a tapestry, a weaving of all that was, and the threads that actually make sense to bring forward in these times are really strong in me, and the ones that aren't as essential feel like they're falling away. And sophistry was born.
Yeah, my 13-year-old Zoe is, and it's not how she was. It's just more evidence of karma and reincarnation and whatever she brought in. You know, a major thing is like curiosity. And connecting with that, and that opens up all the doors to be able to look at all of, you know, what's going on in all of our really tough situations, from the environment to the polarization in this country, and you know, we have, you know, just have and have not and racial. I mean, we go on and on. And she had a point of view for all of it. It was like mind blowing.
It was. It was gorgeous. Yeah.
So, okay. So, selfistry.
Yeah.
All right. I guess you should say, how did you come up with that term?
Well, the term came to me because the language that I was using was self and no self. So the Buddhist, you know, term of no self. Mm. And then the self in the West, which is, you know, the icon that we worship. Yeah. So the polarity, I really got excited about just playing with the polarity between self and no self and how in certain traditions one is valued over the other, one is viewed as primary or superior to the other. And what I realized in my own interior and in my own life was they are actually codependent, co-arising, co-mingling, and that to diminish one over the other was to incur suffering. And so I really wanted to speak to the dynamic relationship between self and no self. And so that's where selfistry, the artistry of the self, and no self. Yeah.
That's cool. Cool term. So the whole, of course, this is how it opens. I spent, well, it doesn't open, but how selfistry came to be. I spent my 30s sitting on a meditation cushion determined to bring about an inner shift that would finally make me happy. And then you go in to describe what happiness means to you. And I thought I'd let you and everybody else know, because I had an interesting incident with Maharaji one day, Neem Karoli Baba, when my father came to India out of the blue almost. And my brother and I were there, my future wife. And he said, I'm coming. And then he came. And we didn't have, shall we say, we didn't have a great relationship. I knew he loved me, and it wasn't like really crazy bad, but he was a tyrant, you know, and so we had a lot of issues. But it wasn't like I wasn't writing him going, you cannot believe what I am sitting in front of this human. I've never met a human like, you know, stuff like that. So that brought him over. So anyhow, all kinds of the usual stuff with Neem Karoli Baba, with Maharaji happened, where you immediately knew he knew absolutely everything, not just what past, but present, future, all of it. And you were taken into a completely altered state, which is really, that's not even the right word. You were home.
Mm.
I just recently did a podcast, actually, with Danny Goldman, an old friend who wrote to Emotional Intelligence, which everybody should read, by the way. I keep saying that. Whenever I say Danny's name, I'm like, you got to do that. So he did a book with Tokni Rinpoche, a great lama. Mm. And in it, Tokni talked about what essence love is, which is that thing behind it all.
Yeah.
And he said, and this just really got me, there's a sense of okayness is what that is.
Yeah.
I love that so much. Anyhow, there I am.
Gorgeous.
With my father. And Maharaji says to him, why did you come to India? And he said, which was more rational than almost any time. Maharaji never talked to people and said anything. He would ask them questions, and it was just a weird thing that, you know, completely non-rational. My father said, well, I came to see how my sons were doing. Mm. This is why he came, you know.
Of course.
And Maharaji said, well, how are they doing? He said, well, they seem happy. And Maharaji said, happiness is everything. I have had that contemplation, you know, for all of these years and come to the understanding of deep, that's why I told this story of Tokni Rinpoche, of the okayness, of the deep okayness of what happiness, that's what happiness is. It's not, as you describe, it's not one day I'm happy, next time I'm sad. You know, it's not an emotional thing. It's way underneath that. But go ahead, talk about it in terms of your own experience with ultimate happiness.
Yeah, that's beautiful. I think what you shared really speaks to it. And my sense of it as well is that there is a place that's always here, that's in us, and that holds us, that is okayness. It's exquisite. It's just this, sometimes I say to people that it's just a relief to finally land there, and from there to feel happy and sad. And from there to witness the horrors in the world and the exquisite beauty in the world, to really be okay with all of it. And not, you know, it's that dance, which is why I call it the artistry of that polarity, like to know that everything is fundamentally okay and to address all the fucked up things in the world at the same time, that those are not mutually exclusive, that when we rest in the okayness, it doesn't mean we just lie down, you know, in a blissed out state and smile and never get up and do anything. On the contrary, it means that when we do get up and do things, it's coming from this rested okayness, and our actions in the world come from a place of love and connection and okayness rather than judgment or attachments or agendas. And my experience is that it's a way more beautiful way for me to live and for the people around me who have to live with me, you know?
I'll second that emotion, as they say.
Yeah.
Yeah. So one other, I imagine this is this particular teaching, which you bring out very early, is something that's dear to you in terms of a not even just a practice, but a point of view, a perspective. And that's the teachings of Ramana Maharshi, and particularly around who am I? And for those of you who don't know who he is, he was a great saint of the last century. And he was 16 years old, and he was like, I don't know what this is, this life, but I'm not moving one more inch until I find out what it's all about. And he lays down on his bed. Remember, 16, right? Teenager. And he just goes, who am I? And he repeats that all night long until he realizes the nature, his nature, his true nature. And then, of course, over years, it took hold, whatever that means, I wouldn't know. And he moved to this fantastic place called Teravamnamalai in South India and has this beautiful Shiva mountain. What's it called?
Arunachala.
Arunachala. God, I was there. It was the first holy place I ever went to in India.
Wow.
When I was 24.
Wow.
And that practice was and is for many people a real way to identify the okayness place, right? And yeah, talk about your own connection to him and what those teachings mean to you.
Yeah, he came to me early on in a dream and then a book of his that I just used that practice. I think one of the things I loved about my relationship with Sam was we were always looking for Occam's razor. You know, we were always looking for the simplest, most direct path or the most direct understanding of what's true. And so Ramana's injunction to just keep asking the question, who am I, really resonated with me, and the Zen meditation type practice I was doing combined with Ram Dass's teaching of from role to soul. So every time I would sit, I would allow myself to ask the question, who am I? And roles would pop up. One, I'm a woman, I'm a teacher, I'm a daughter, I'm, you know, on and on. And I would just keep sinking into, okay, not that. Okay, not that. What else? What else? Right. And so in my conversation with Ram Dass, when I spent time with him before he died, and I was sharing with him that movement from role to soul, it was when Ram Dass says, I am loving awareness. Hmm. to me, for me, that was the soul place, right? I am Sarah is the self. I am loving awareness is the soul, because there's still an I there. There's a sense of me there. But loving awareness itself is the okayness. So it's like, I am Sarah. I am loving awareness, love.
Yeah. I'll tell you, you're just reminding me of something. We were you may have been there at the retreat in Maui. And I'm sitting up there with Ram Dass and Krishna Dass one day. And Ram Dass starts talking about the constituents of I am loving awareness and going from that I place in your head into the center of your being. And anyhow, he's going on talking about it. And he turns and he looks at Krishna at one point and goes, you know, right? Right? Or maybe he didn't say that, but he was prompting Krishna Dass in some way. And, you know, Krishna Dass, who can't do stuff just because it's nice to do in any situation. I can't tell you what he said on his broadcast of a few Thursdays ago. He does that thing every Thursday night. Yeah. It was phenomenal. Best spiritual teaching I ever heard. And it was completely profane.
Another Jewish brother, right?
Yeah, yes. Exactly. Yeah, yeah. Yeah. So Krishna Dass, when he was prompted relative to I am loving awareness, said, I don't know anything about loving awareness. I know Ram Ram. Okay, that's all I know. And then Ram Dass was sort of taken aback. He's like, all these years, you never said a word about it? And then Ram Dass just stopped for a moment and he went, loving awareness, Ram Ram,
yeah.
Something like that. But the I am left. And just the reality of, you know, what we're talking about is deeply below the I. Yeah. But you need an eye to kind of get there. And that's the usefulness, as you said before. You can't throw out, it's no self, and you don't throw out the self because it's a useful servant, actually.
Yeah.
You know, that self. And it's not to me, it's not about the Buddhist no self thing. It's the dropping of attachment, clinging, and aversion.
Nice.
When those things drop, then you're able to be completely at one in present moment with everyone and everything around you. That's no self, as far as I'm concerned. So, yeah.
Yeah, I love that. I one thing I say to people who I'm walking with is that this notion of even dropping it, right? Sometimes that feels insurmountable for people. So what I like to say is it's a perspective shift in a way. And the self realm, the part of us that there's a lot of different selves inside of here, actually. And one of them is so not interested or able to drop her attachments. But when I'm able to get perspective on her and see her as just a play, right? Leela, just a play of selfhood, then I don't need her to change or do anything, but my attention is rooted in observing her. And then at some point, it's just rooted in okayness.
Mm. Yeah.
So I'd love to qualify that, because sometimes people are like, oh, I'll never let go of all my attachments. I'll never. It's too hard. How do you do that? And I just say to them, let's just set them down on a table right here for a while. And they don't have to go anywhere. They don't have to change. And bring your attention here. At least to the I am loving awareness. Start identifying as the I who is loving awareness, and then we'll get rid of the I altogether. Yeah, right. You know.
Yeah. Well, we won't get rid of it, but again, no. We'll get enough spaciousness around it, so we are not reacting the way we normally do with input that from people, from things, from circumstances, whatever it may be.
Ancestry. Everything. Yeah. That's a big one.
Yeah. You know what turned me on to Ramana Maharshi?
What?
I mean, aside from, I did go to the ashram and I went to his room, his mausoleum, all of it. It's all good.
Yeah.
I mean, at that stage, actually, I wasn't getting it really, you know, not the way I did did after I finally met Maharaji. Although I, you know, I had, with Ram Dass, I did get a certain kind of a hit that was very deeply trustful, intuitive, of that space.
Beautiful.
But then I read the story. There used to be, with Ramana Maharshi, there was this one cow, Gita, can't remember her name, but there was a cow, you know, so there was every ashram around India, nearby, or as part of the ashram, there's a cow, Goshal, I think it's called, but it's cows that are taken care of, and, you know, for milk and so on. And this one particular cow, he loved, Ramana Maharshi loved that cow. Have you heard this? The cow used to come in to the darshan room, poop on the floor, everything. Complete no-no in Hindu, especially Brahmin culture. And he'd give it some food. It would hang out in the meditation and then go back to the cow shed. Promptly every day.
Wow.
On its own, wasn't anybody saying, okay, it's time for darshan, she would come. And the way that he treated that cow, I mean, I'm a big animal lover, but whatever it was, the purity of love and kindness that he exemplified, to me, was way more powerful than the practice, which wasn't something that attracted me particularly because I'm less into gyan kind of stuff than I am into bhakti. Mm-hmm. That's not totally true because of the Tibetans that I've been privileged to take teachings from and meet. But yeah, Ramana Maharshi. Absolutely. Yeah. Fantastic.
And I love that you brought the animals into the conversation, because really, you know, that from that place of okayness, when we turn our attention back into the world and pick up the sheath of our selfhood in order to dance in life, we feel our connection to the whole web of inner being. And there is no separation. And how we care for our beloveds is the same as how we care for the animals and the plants and the cosmos, right?
Yeah, directly connected to what's going on with the environment and the things that we can do, starting off with the most, one would think, insignificant things.
Exactly.
Yeah, highly, highly important on every level. That's a whole other conversation, actually. One of the things you bring up, and you mentioned it, you know, around the witness, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I think that's, I talk about it myself all the time within the mindfulness context of, like, we have a course going on now, Ram Dass and Friends, actually, course called the Yoga, Ram Dass's Yoga of Heartfulness, right? And, we developed this course. It, you know, started out to be, okay, bhakti yoga, it's too bound into some tradition that is not us now kind of a thing. But what's the reality? Ram Dass exemplifies, you know, giving a shit about other people. Just start right there.
Yep.
You know, and you, we all, those of us that met him, and even those of us that didn't, even through a talk, you can tell the warmth, the honesty, the caring, the kindness, the, he would pay attention to you.
Yeah.
And if somebody else tried to distract him, he would get pissed at them, you know?
Yeah.
Oh, he's tired. He's got to move. I have stories upon stories of me doing the wrong thing when he wanted to just hang with people, you know, trying to be a producer with him. He did. But then people, we have a whole chat thing going. A forum where people can talk to each other about, you know, the different talking points from the course. And people were going, okay, well, you know, in certain, that heartfulness, in certain circumstances, it's really not hard to connect with. But it's the day-to-day life when you're in your quote unquote grind, which makes life seem like not that fun, but it just everybody knows what we're talking about. How do we bring it in then? How do we maintain the depth at which one would want to be at, where it's not so ephemeral? It's not, when it's easy to do, it's okay. But when it's not okay. And so what we bring up is, and what I would tell anybody, is mindfulness. Until you get interior, I mean, so obviously you can do the Who Am I, Ramana Maharshi's practice, that will get you into the right place of being able to be heartful. But witness, and this is something that was very important, Ram Dass, especially in the beginning days, talked about, and not the judgy mind witness, but the loving awareness witness. And yeah, you talk about it because you've really explicated it quite well.
Well, two things come up for me. One is that was actually the heart of the conversation that Ram Dass and I had. He really understood, like in Selfistry, there's these three realms, the self and source or no self, and then the witness. And he was really curious what this witness realm was. And until he felt clear that it was equivalent to the I am loving awareness that he was pointing towards, he was reticent to give it his thumbs up, right? And mm-hmm. so when we started, and this is the beauty, I think, of these times, is that one of the things, and you, I'm sure, can relate to this as a teacher and a guide, one of the things we're being called to do is define our terms really well, find a language that really can communicate to others the certain states or realms that we're pointing towards, or capacities or traits. And so when we talk about the witness and we talk about this capacity to, I call it sacred multitasking, right? To be in the grind and also to be in the witness, to do both at the same time, is something we cultivate through practice. And that's the beauty of practice. It's not that practice is something in and of itself to attain perfection at. It's in service to showing up in the grind in good ways. And Ram Dass's first book points so clearly to that, in that the title is not Be Here Now. The title is Remember Be Here Now. And so when we're in the grind, if we can just remember, oh, I'm in the grind. In that moment, just that awareness of it. Then I say to my students, whatever tools you have in your toolbox right there to help you come back to loving awareness, use it. And I recommend you have more than one tool in that toolbox to use. So let's find different tools and let's build you a really, you know, sufficient toolbox to handle the grindiest of the grinds.
The grimiest of the grinds.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, there are so many methods, which is wonderful. But certainly mindfulness, which includes witness, development of awareness, spaciousness, is a huge tool, because you can, well, it's wonderful to be able to see the self-motivated, very selfish motivations that we have, that we carry on. And that's the grind, really.
Yeah.
It's not what we have to do to pay our bills and, you know, fulfill all our work responsibilities, home life, all of that. That's not the grind. The grind is getting lost. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And wound up.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, it's cool. You talk about something I've been talking to people about, all sorts of different people, which, you know, that's the wonderful thing about a podcast. You get to talk to different people, and certainly neuroscience in the last number of years has been, you know, a wonderful subject to talk to people about. But you only need to say, I really think only one thing needs to be communicated, and it gives us hope. Wise hope, as Roshi Halifax would say. And that is the fact that change can happen in those neurons, okay, in your whatever.
Neuroplasticity.
It can happen. I mean, they're proving that out.
Yeah.
And that should give everyone a little bit of hope, because many people go, well, you know, I'm not going to change from, well, you don't exactly, your personality isn't going to change. True. But your relationship with everything you come into contact is definitely going to change.
Yeah.
You know, and really, Sarah, it just points to thinking outside of oneself. I mean, the truth is, and that's why Ram Dass, well, we got the thing from Maharaji, love, serve, remember. And the serve part is, boy, it's not just going to help whoever you are serving. Here's the key. It doesn't just help the other person or situation. It helps you enormously, because in the doing of it, you suddenly are like not thinking about yourself for a minute even.
Yeah.
You know how valuable that is?
Yeah. Yeah, so. I love that. I love the neuroplasticity. I'm a geek about the neuroscience as well, and really feel like what you said earlier about making more space. It's not necessarily that our personalities change and those neural pathways don't continue to fire, but we make space for other neural pathways to come online, the ones that are able to witness, the ones that are already there. And then all of a sudden we have a new capacity to behave in new ways and to believe and think in new and feel even in new ways.
Yeah.
And I love that. And I love, I don't know if you're familiar with theories of adult development and Robert Keegan's work out of Harvard. It's beautiful, beautiful study. But the essence of it is that in order for us to grow out of a, let's say, a developmental stage, we see kids do it naturally. They go from crawling to walking to, but as adults, we have the capacity to grow as well. And the key, he says, to activating that development is our ability to be self-aware, which is mindfulness in the more spiritual term. And there's something about that to all of a sudden go, whoa, to be able to look at yourself without becoming self-absorbed. It's not that kind of looking. It's the kind of looking like, whoa, who's looking?
Yeah, right.
You know?
Yeah,
just so there's a lot of evidence. Yeah, there's a lot of tools, a lot of evidence, a lot of frameworks and languages for what Maharaji was pointing us towards.
Yeah. No, you know, absolutely.
It's so beautiful. We're so lucky.
You have one method here that's probably my favorite thing. I'm going to steal it for you. From
okay.
You.
Okay. Go. Love it.
No, you've already mentioned it. Sit down and shut up.
So simple, right? So hard. It's so
that's
simple.
Like, you know how Be Here Now came about? Ram Dass was with Bhagavan Dass in India in the Land Rover, and he was taking Ram Dass. He wanted to see his guru, and Ram Dass was just going along for the ride. It was a long ride from Kathmandu all the way. So Ram Dass kept going on about, he had a lot of stories to go on about all the psychedelic experimental stuff and Leary and everything. And he'd go on and on. And then finally, Bhagavan Dass said, can you just be here now for a minute?
Okay. I love it.
That's how that came about.
Yep.
You know,
can you just sit down and shut up for a minute? Yeah, totally. I love it.
Is that how it came up? How did it get up?
That's Sam. That's totally Sam. Yeah,
okay,
yeah, yeah.
So it's a good thing. I shouldn't be mad at him.
No, he said some good things.
Is he still with us, by the way?
He is.
Uh-huh.
He is, yeah. I haven't had contact with him in almost 2 decades, but I suspect he's still doing his thing. And I have a lot of love and respect for what he provided for me and my own development. So
yeah,
we can
absolutely
assess his psychological well-being at another time.
Yeah, well, it's not even our business whatsoever.
That's true.
Your business more particularly.
Good point.
Yeah.
Good point.
Yeah. Mm. That, by the way, these books we will have... you. links so you can purchase them.
Thank you.
But everybody out there, yeah, the memoir, I mean, I love memoirs myself. Mm. And this one, you've had such a profoundly varied life and gone through so much stuff. I think a lot of people will relate. And certainly your point of view as a woman is very self-evident in terms of what you have, the experiences you've had directly, the relationships that you've had. I think there's a way that you're embodying something that's really important for the female gender. Whoever identifies that way, by the way, I'm not saying anything different.
Yep, I hear you. I feel you.
So we're almost out of time, but there's one last thing I want you to talk about. I think... because you talk about Ramana Maharshi and self-inquiry through the mind, which again is a very powerful, I don't want to suggest because it wasn't something that grabbed me, and that was back in the day when I was young. And it's very powerful. And some of the things that Sarah's talking about here are absolutely rooted in that concept. Of really finding your true self. And then you have what you talked about, still being moved, which engages self-inquiry through the body. Talk about that. And this is something, yeah, I think there's people out there that can really use this in a way that, you know, maybe they can't get to this, you know, kyan, the intellectual yoga of self-inquiry.
Thank you for the question. One of the things Ram Dass said when he decided to endorse this work, and he said, and that's written on the back of the Self-History book, is he said, you know, that Sarah's a trustworthy guide. And I love that word because I feel like guide really speaks to, or mentor speaks to, what I offer. And in the still being moved practice, what I'm offering and creating the space for is for people to explore the realms of the witness of source or no self and our multifaceted selfhood through the body. So there's the room is created for that practice, and there's music that's curated to support that practice. I couple it with the rigorous, more masculine, cognitive sit down and shut up practice as well. So I encourage people, I guide people into both, because I feel like through both of them, we can have a real deep understanding and a real deep and heartened embodiment of the complexity of what we are as selves and no selves, and the essential simplicity of it. So some people through the somatic practice will really find that okayness realm so much easier and so much quicker than those of us who had the capacity and the discipline to sit down and shut up for hours on end, for days on end. So I love that it is kind of a more feminine, you were speaking to women, you know, and how my gender and my experience as a woman in this life really informs my work and my guidance. I feel like the still being moved practice and self-history in general is a more feminine approach to awakening to the truth of who we are. And I have a very strong masculine self inside as well. And I love silent meditation practice and austerities and, you know, that as well. So those are, you know, again, different tools in the toolbox. Plus still being moved is so much fun. And it's a community thing. Like we
do it with
other people. So we find a room, a big enough room where we can move around in, and we dedicate one portion of the room for the self, which is usually the middle of the room, and the periphery of the room is the witness space. And then we have a space that's dedicated to source or no self. And then I curate a playlist of music that takes an arc of a journey that can activate And so I put the music on, and then you just take your body through the realms and see what happens. So, you know, some people say, oh, you're dancing, but it's not really dancing. It's moving. It's taking the soma through the realms and observing and feeling and emoting and laughing and crying, and whatever wants to happen happens. And then we unpack it. We harvest it, and we talk about, well, what happened when you took your body in the witness realm and observed source and self from there? What did you notice? What did you feel? And what happened when you were in the self realm and acting out a certain emotion or a certain feeling sense? What happened when you were there? Could you feel source in the room? Could you feel the witness in the room? And somehow it provides the conditions for the embodiment of it in a totally different way. And it's taken from, some of the listeners might be familiar with Gabrielle Roth's work, or Soul Motion, or so I did a lot of work in those lineages as well, that informs the Still Be Moved creation of that practice.
And there's someone named Zuleika who does wonderful work in this same vein out of Santa Fe, actually.
Awesome.
It's been part of our New Mexico.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah.
Yay. Cool.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Sarah.
Thank you, Raghu. It's a pleasure to hang out with you for a while.
Well, I've been hanging out with you for a couple of days, actually, unbeknownst to you.
Oh, that's true. That's very true. And I have been with you, listening to your other podcast conversations. Super
Thank
sweet.
You.
Yeah.
Thank you. As I said, everybody, in the show notes, we'll have links to these couple of books so that you can... what about website?
Selfistry.com.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Yeah.
And you do other things? Like,
I do.
People can gather together somewhere where you're doing these things, right?
Yeah. I do things all over the world, different times, different places, private groups, retreats.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Well, take advantage. Sarah lives now. You said you're moving, but you're in Marin.
We're in the East Bay, and we're moving to Marin.
Oh, you know, that's it. Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Very good.
Yeah.
Very good. So, everybody, this is Mind Rolling. And go to BeHereNowNetwork.com/mindrolling. You'll see the show notes on this show and the links and everything else to get you in touch with Sarah. And again, Sarah, thank you for being
here. Thank you, Raghu. My pleasure.
Thank you.
Yeah.
All right, everybody. We'll see you next week.
Take care, everybody.
Bye-bye.
Bye.